I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back.
So as we wind our way down in the election, coming up on the election very soon in just a matter of days, reminding you that you can vote early in Maryland from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. through this Thursday, June the 19th. The primary election will take place this Tuesday, June 24th. You can find out more by visiting elections.state.md.us. Find out where you can do that. One of those people you may want to vote for, may not, depends on who you like, who you don't, is Heather Mazier, Maryland State Delegate from Montgomery County, who is running to be the Democratic nominee and joins us once again in the studio. Heather, good to see you.
Always a pleasure, Mark. Thank you so much.
So, Heather, I was about to say the call number, except that we're taping this, so we can't. But we can listen to the conversation and just let us know and let them know what you think of what you've heard. So we're coming down to the wire here in this campaign. It was interesting that, I don't know if you saw, sometimes I know you hate the question like this, but you can throw something at me if you like. But there was an article that by Evan Serpik, I don't know if you saw this or not, "Could Mazier Be the Brat of the Left?" He wrote this piece.
And let's clarify that's somebody's name.
Exactly. The man who
although the establishment machine in Maryland might consider me the brat of the left nonetheless.
That's right. I guess it was a play on words for his perspective.
Yes.
With a little slow on the uptake there. But what he was saying was that you look at the polls and you see undecideds also, but they're shrinking, and you see how far ahead Anthony Brown is to others in the polls that have come out. And that's what he was alluding to here.
What he's alluding to is the fact that if Eric Cantor can lose in Virginia, Heather Mazier certainly can win in Maryland. And that's what we're seeing in these final days of this race. It's about momentum. It's about an excited desire by the voters to come out and support a different future for our state. And we are seeing that enthusiasm and excitement all across the state. Delman and I have been traveling to the early voting centers in every region of the state. And no matter where we go, people are rushing out of their cars, going into the centers, giving us hugs and saying, "I'm voting for you. I'm voting for you." We see it on Facebook. We see it on Twitter. We know that there is a level of excitement out there that is surging right now between winning the debates, having really good final closing arguments in our TV commercials, which we always knew we were going to be the late surging candidacy because we wouldn't be able to afford to put our ads on TV until the very end. We're a publicly financed campaign. We're the first in 20 years to join into this system and on top of it self-impose additional restrictions on no corporate and special interest money because we want voters to know that we are accountable to them. We're trying to restore integrity to the process and return Annapolis to the people. And that is getting people excited to engage in this election who normally are sitting on the sidelines. Those people are never going to be called in a poll. And we know that we got what it takes to win, running a positive, issue-based campaign. Voters are tired of cynical politics that bicker and tear each other down and instead are excited about an opportunity to focus on bold, innovative solutions, a positive approach to how we are going to address our toughest challenges, rebuilding community and lifting everyone up to their highest potential. That's what the voters of Maryland are ready for, and that's what the Mazier Coates ticket has given them.
So many people who've called in or written it over time are worried that all the things that you lay out that you would do if you become governor of the state of Maryland, that there's no way to pay for all this stuff. The taxes have to go up. It doesn't balance out.
Everything is absolutely balanced. I am a progressive, but I am also incredibly pragmatic and fiscally responsible. And what we promote in this campaign is a very balanced approach. Let's walk through it. Our middle class tax cuts are paid for by bringing the millionaire's tax back. The millionaire's tax was allowed to expire in Maryland while everyone else's taxes were raised. We turn that around. We can give 90% of families tax relief that you're not going to get rich on, but who doesn't want a few extra $100 in their pocket? And that is economic stimulus. We use it and we go out and we buy school supplies or shoes for our children or eat out at restaurants more often. That's how we grow our economy from the middle out. We are asking for our small businesses and other all employers to pay not just a minimum wage, but a living wage. So people aren't working 40 hours a week and living in poverty anymore. And one of the ways we accomplish that is closing a tax loophole that allows a handful of corporations to get out without paying any Maryland taxes because they're hiding the money they make in Maryland on the books in other states where they operate. We make them pay their fair share. We generate $200 million of new revenue that we dedicate to small business tax relief. We'll give you meaningful tax reform and ask you to pay higher wages. We have an early childhood education program that is focused on eliminating the achievement gap in our schools because, unfortunately, in Maryland, it still matters what your socioeconomic status is and what your race is to determine whether or not you're going to be successful in school. And if we give universal pre-K plan for all four-year-olds and a half day for three-year-olds, we can eliminate those disparities and allow kids to enter school ready to learn at the same pace. There's a cost to that. But the way we're funding it is by addressing another critical policy priority in our state, and that's our failed war on drugs. Our marijuana prohibition laws have been a failure. They are enforced with racial bias. They detract our law enforcement from focusing on more violent and serious crimes. And when we bring that underground economy to the light of day, regulate it, have the state in charge of retail shops where only adults can buy, and we improve our chances of keeping it out of the hands of youth, we also generate $160 million of new taxes that we pay for those early childhood education initiatives. And finally, that's not even counting, Mark, the savings that are generated because we're not sending people to jail for marijuana possessions anymore. We're spending an average of $280 million a year on the incarceration, detention, and court cost associated with marijuana possessions. 23,000 people arrested every year for this. This is how you build a budget around your priorities. You set your priorities and you build a budget around it. We get $112 million from the millionaire's tax, middle class tax relief. We get $200 million from closing that small business or that corporate loophole. We give it to small businesses. We bring in $160 million of new revenue every year from legalizing marijuana dedicated to those universal pre-K programs. There's a very balanced approach to all of this, and for those who want to dig into more of the details, they should go to our website, Heather Mizier, MIZEUR.com. We believe in total transparency and what we're proposing and exactly how we'll pay for it.
So, I mean, how much will your pre-K program cost? Is it only $160? It sounds to me that's kind of small. It must cost more than that.
It does cost more than that. And there's a range of other proposals in the budget on cost-saving measures and mechanisms. Right now, we're about maybe $40 million short of doing everything we've proposed all in one fell swoop. But everything that we've proposed, we are talking about doing on a phased basis, so that as the money becomes available, we'll be able to move to the next phase. We're not going to move forward on a next phase expansion until we have the resources to do it. And we feel very confident that that the proposal we've laid out and the savings that get generated, that's not even accounting for those savings that we've discussed on the decriminalization side.
But that, because that $280 million you mentioned on decriminalization of marijuana, on incarceration, the $200 million we spend on incarceration does not all involve marijuana.
Yes.
You're saying that portion of the budget is all marijuana?
That's just marijuana.
But that's the thing I didn't know. I thought that was closer to $280 million is what we spend on incarcerating.
Our best guess estimates based on academic research and testimony that was provided before the General Assembly, yes.
So then how does that lead to any kind of reform, and how important is that reform of the criminal justice system overall? So I'm saying, if we're not locking up people who are arrested for marijuana, then how do you envision that changes or alters the way we address the whole criminal justice system?
Well, it's a change that is welcome. We shouldn't be putting people into jail for nonviolent possession charges. We should be focusing on more violent and serious crimes. And we have to get to a place where we're not just smart on crime or tough on crime. We have to be smart on crime. And shifting approach that I'd like to see us change our current money bail system to a risk release system. There are four states that use this. Instead of putting a price on someone's head for their freedom, where if you don't have the resources to pay your bail, you're stuck in a detention facility, even if you're a nonviolent offender, losing access to your job and your paycheck and creating a downhill slide that might keep you stuck in a pattern of recidivism. there are four states that say, we are going to look at what danger you pose to society and make a decision on whether or not to hold you in detention based on your risk rather than whether or not you can afford to pay bail. It's a fair approach, and it also saves the criminal justice detention costs. We should eliminate mandatory minimum sentencing because it takes away the discretion of a judge to actually determine what proper sentencing guidelines are. We're not doing enough to acknowledge that reentry into a community starts at entry, and that we have to start getting people ready to get back in the community once they've served their debt to society and connect them with jobs and housing opportunities. We're talking about plussing up programs that work inside our criminal justice system to advance those connections. Early intervention for at-risk youth, key. Why are we trying youth as adults? Why are we always focused on building another youth jail? I was proud 3 years ago to stand shoulder to shoulder with advocates in this city to reject building the youth jail in Baltimore because it was going to be a 120-bed facility for what were 40-some youth in the system at the time at a cost of $70 million. And we know that in our current mass incarceration approach, if we build it, we'll fill it. And we have to start shifting our focus and attention towards keeping violent criminals where they need to be and working on rehabilitation and disconnecting nonviolent criminals from the revolving door of living in a life of crime.
So, one of your opponents in this Democratic primary, Attorney General Gensler, has said that this what you're talking about with the millionaire's tax is going to drive more people with means out of the state. And many Republican opponents are also saying that this has driven businesses out. They've gone to Virginia. We've lost businesses because of these taxes. And that's the very problem, is that we're charging that. Let's just stop there. I have a second part.
That's conservative propaganda.
Why is it propaganda?
Because the numbers don't bear out that fact. Maryland has per capita more millionaires than any other state in the nation. People choose to live here because it's an amazing place to live, work, and raise a family. There's lots of decisions on where someone chooses to live and stay in a state. Some of it's tax policy, and a fair and balanced approach is what most people are looking for, including millionaires. It's also what kind of investments are we making in a 21st century transportation system? What kind of schools are we building for the children to grow up and manage this economy that we are building? What kind of protection do we have in place for our natural resources and to make sure that our Chesapeake Bay is able to live up to a healthier place where we can not just recreate, but make sure that watermen and others are able to continue earning a living on the bay? There is a total balance to this. Large businesses talk to me about the regulatory environment more than they do the tax environment.
What do you mean by the regulatory environment? That's something that's become a huge piece of conversations about the future of government. Charles Lawlor and many Republicans are all talking about there's too much regulation on our businesses. So what are you when you talk about regulation, what specifically are you talking about? Do you think that has to be cut or
dropped
down?
I'm talking about striking the right balance. We always have to have consumer protections in place. That's why government plays an important role in regulation. But regulation without proper oversight can sometimes have unintended consequences. When I looked into a few years ago to try to figure out why we weren't doing residential compost pickup at our homes the way we do with recycling, I talked to the large industrial composting facilities, and they told me, I'm not going to operate in Maryland because you have an ag department, a natural resources department, and an environment department that all have three separate rules and regulations on what we do with that compost once we pick it up. And businesses like certainty above all else, and they want to know what the rules of engagement are. And we were sending a message that Maryland wasn't open for business. So these large employers were opening up shops in Pennsylvania and Delaware, but not coming to Maryland. I sat down over a series of months with those stakeholders from the private sector, the agency officials and advocates, to hammer out a unified approach about one set of rules that would both protect consumers and regulate the business in a way that they felt like they could come and set up shop here. And as a result, the Institute for Local Self-Reliance has credited that work as creating a pathway for 1,400 green economy composting jobs in Maryland over the next 3 to 5 years. We've already seen residential composting come in place in Montgomery and Howard County and parts of Baltimore City, and it's going to keep growing.
So does that mean you say that you agree with some of your Republican opponents that our bureaucracy in the state of Maryland is too complex, is too overbearing, that we need to cut it back?
I think that we always should have an eye as government on how we simultaneously balance the challenges of protecting our consumers, but also being business friendly and encouraging their success rather than throwing up barriers to entry. And I would create the Office of the Business Advocate, elevate it to a cabinet level position to be specifically focused on ways of eliminating overlapping regulations that are sending inappropriate signal to businesses that our climate is one that is too challenging to operate in.
You know, as we look to the future, one of the things that's going to face this state as it is every other state, because we could be facing many more economic crises in this country ahead of us, has to do with pensions and paying state workers' pensions, state workers' health benefits. That there are many people saying that they're going to have to kind of renege on our responsibility, our commitment, I should say, to pay for those retirement benefits. So, I mean, and I've asked everybody this question. So what's your plan to deal with that huge structural deficit and to deal with the looming pension crisis that people see coming down the road? Mm-hmm. Because it may come barreling in under the next governor's watch. Mm-hmm.
We, in 2011, made some pretty significant changes to pension policy to address that concern proactively. We asked our state employees to pay more into their pension and share a higher obligation. We changed the vesting rules so that we could get the value of those underfunded pensions up to a level that we felt more confident in Maryland's long-term fiscal future related to the pensions. The problem is, in this legislative session, in order to close a gap in our budget, the administration went into the fund as it's been building up and snagged $200 million out of it just to plug budget gaps. Promises made on pensions need to be promises kept. My father was a United Auto worker for 32 years, and one of his decisions in deciding to retire was, hey, I'm a wage worker. I'm never going to get rich. Let me make a decision on whether or not I can live on the promises of my pension and my health care that's associated with that. Did the math and determined it'll be tight, but we can live on this. Over the course of his retirement and about his eighth year in, the promise on his health care always being covered was reneged. And now one-third of his pension cost is going to pay for his health care needs. My parents aren't able to make ends meet under that. I understand at a really core level how important it is that we keep those promises. And when there are tough budget decisions to be made, we need to make them based on our existing revenues and expenditures rather than dipping into pensions. I feel like we're on a strong glide path with the changes we made in 2011 to take care of all of our future pension obligations, but not if we keep dipping into the reserves to pay for budget gaps as they come up.
I mean, every governor I've interviewed over the last 21 years in this program, whether it's the lone Republican or all the Democrats, have dipped into the transportation fund or some education trust fund or dipped into the pension fund, as you just talked about now, to make ends meet at the end so the budget can be balanced at the end of the year. So, I mean, so why – what would be any different under your administration? I mean, nobody seems to be able to put their hands around this. You've got to deal with all these senators and delegates. They all have these different ideas about what should be done. Mm-hmm. And no one's been able to put their hands around how to make this budget work and make the future work. So I guess what we're not hearing.
You're right to be skeptical, Mark, because you're right. It has become a way of doing business in Annapolis. But I think it's become that default approach because too often the people in charge are more worried about their reelection than they are about making the right choices and decisions. And I'm not running for governor because I want the title or I just want the job. I want to do the job. And that means making difficult decisions sometimes. It means taking a risk of making people upset with the choices that have to be made. But that's why we're making a decision on who to send there. And it's a lot easier to trust that the person who isn't backed by corporate special interest, establishment interest, political groups, is going to go in there with the independence to make these tough choices, because that's exactly the kind of campaign I've run.
So, I'm just going to push a little bit harder on that, because I think people really want to know, and nobody seems to be able to adequately answer this question, is how do you end up balancing those budgets without raiding funds? And raiding funds just depletes from our ability to build rail or to take care of highways or ensuring that people have pensions. So how do you do that? I mean, how are you going to ensure that you don't have to dip in there, or that we're not going to be in some great deficit crisis?
I'll give you an immediate example on that. Why this legislative session did we allow an estate tax to be passed that is giving $432 million of tax giveaways in an election year to the heirs of millionaires, the top 3% wealthiest families in the state?
Why did that happen?
Well, there was one person standing up on the floor raising a lot of commotion about it, and that was me. But I didn't have a lot of support because there was a decision among leadership in Annapolis that this was the deal that had to be cut. This is what we needed to get done this session for the interests that make Annapolis run. And that increases obligations on middle-class families to keep funding the cost of infrastructure and schools and healthcare. If we are having leadership that rejects decisions like that, then we're not having to dip into and make money stretch anywhere else. We wouldn't be talking about $200 million of cuts to pension funds if we weren't so eager to make sure that we were giving estate tax giveaways to millionaires. There are choices that get made in Annapolis. And when we have someone at the very top that is making decisions for average middle-class families and what is the right thing to do in Maryland and is willing to make decisions about setting priorities and building a budget around it, that's how we're going to change the way this gets done.
So I'm coming back to some of the ideas that you've talked about and that people argued on this campaign trail about. And I think that one of the kind of big fears is that we're going to be a state that's locked into state lottery systems and gambling to pay for what we need in the future. I'm not saying this from some moralistic perspective. I'm saying it because we do things that kind of, in some senses, takes the money out of working people's pockets rather than have people save, so we can fund the state government through our casinos and lottery and things like that. This is a very hard thing to get away from, because that is where a huge chunk of our revenue comes from. Mm-hmm. Should it stay there?
Well, the voters supported it by referendum. And while I was opposed to it and argued heavily, not only voted against it, but argued heavily during the referendum about why I thought we should reject Question 7, in part because it's not a high road to economic development for the very reasons that you discuss. It leads to more crime, addiction, and poverty. And we certainly could do a lot better by putting people to work, rebuilding our schools, building transit lines. And when we had a special session called in Annapolis for the purpose of addressing the quote-unquote crisis associated with the casino expansion, I was trying to make the case that the real crisis in our state was our underfunding of the Transportation Trust Fund and how we could put 15,000 people to work building a red line in Baltimore, wherever the alignment might end up, that we build 27,000 jobs in building the Purple Line connecting Montgomery and Prince George's County, that I was walking through the schools of Baltimore City and being struck in the middle of Holabird Academy when children are unable to drink out of the water fountains because of the lead pipes and taking exams in their coats because the heaters don't work. Why aren't we putting people to work rebuilding our schools and coming up with those approaches? Now, I'm thankful that after we got beyond the casino question, we did bring everyone back to address those issues, and we did get our Transportation Trust Fund up and going. We did find a way to have another $1 billion of investment in our schools, which, by the way, I'm making sure we have a plan on the table for phase two construction so that we get all of those schools built, not just in Baltimore City, but around the state. It's a $15 billion backlog across this across the entire state of Maryland. These are big challenges.
So very finally, the Mazier, let me just let you finally close out with what you think is the message you want to leave voters in these days leading up to the election. In the last few seconds we have left, a couple of minutes.
Thank you so much, Mark. I always appreciate the dialogue that we're able to have together. This is a critical election. There are really, really big challenges facing us, and we can either keep going with the status quo approaches, or we can try something very different and join your neighbors and your family and your coworkers in learning more about this campaign that is about getting middle-class families the voice they need in Annapolis, for turning our minimum wage into a living wage, for making sure that middle-class families and seniors on fixed incomes earn more and are taxed less. We can provide a tax cut to 90% of our families by bringing that millionaire's tax back. We can provide meaningful small business tax relief by asking corporations to pay their fair share. We can eliminate the achievement gap in our schools with a truly universal pre-K plan and child care subsidies for not just low-income families, but also middle-class families, paid for by recognizing that our marijuana prohibition laws have been a failure, and that when we legalize, tax, and regulate marijuana, we have enough revenue to invest in these critical priorities. That we want to put the oil and gas companies on notice that we are unequivocal champions for the environment and a clean bay, and that we're going to stand up for homeowners and not the big banks and lenders. There's really a big choice in this election about picking a governor who will be on your side or who will be on the side of status quo and the way it's always been done in Annapolis. And I'd be forever grateful to earn your support in this campaign.
Heather Mazier, seeking to become the Democratic nominee on this election coming up in front of us on June the 24th. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, Mark.
We have to take a very brief break, but don't go away. When we come back, it's a brand new episode of Soundbites, and we'll listen to another Good Food Gathering town hall meeting that I moderated at the Franciscan Center in Baltimore on donating well. Panelists who are involved, all of whom are involved in innovative programs in the community, wrestled with this question to start with. How do we find creative ways to provide fresh, healthy food for all of our community members? Don't want to miss this conversation. It was really powerful and incredible. Stay with us. We'll be right back.